Session number 12394, Jim Gilbert, Reel 4.
Gilbert, Reel 4.
So I was speaking of the jelly roll, and it in essence enabled us to draw maps, and then we could send these maps by courier to the respective company commanders and keep people apprised of new intelligence, and as things developed, our war plans would change and the maps would reflect those changes. So it was, but the contrast of taking nothing that's going to burden you, and all of the reactive kinds of things that we did as structured, and abandoning all of those things because we didn't want to appear haste, like we were operating in haste, and we didn't want to appear like we were going to potentially be an aggressor, had never happened before. And so the casualness was scary, and the things, like you would get into trouble for not bringing the typewriter. You know, I mean, it would be a serious offense because you would not have the equipment you needed to accomplish your mission, and that was serious stuff for these people. And it just showed how, when it really gets down to it, you need to be unencumbered and quick and flexible and able to think on the fly. And you didn't need all these machines and stuff holding you back, so to speak. I don't really know much about the invasion of Czechoslovakia. It happened while I was there, and I spent 3 days on the border in our actual positions. I remember the man that I really worked for was I don't even mind naming him, Frederick Biggins. I don't think I've ever met anybody that was as good and professional at what he did as this man. He spent 7 years teaching at the War College. And in doing that, he took himself out of the promotion stream. He went in as a first sergeant, spent 7 years there, and left as a first sergeant. He taught majors, colonels, lieutenant colonels, and generals infantry tactics and map reading. And he was an expert, and would have been immediately commissioned as at least a battalion commander if a shot had been fired. I mean, this man was, and he ran our battalion. The battalion commander wasn't all that sharp, but he was sharp enough to know that Biggins will get it done, and he'll get it done well. And this was important to the battalion commander because his performance is rated on how we did and what we did. And mispick was one of the things. And Biggins was great. And so he and I shared the same track, the Army Personnel Carrier, we call them tracks. The way it worked out is that I'm bright, and this man treated me respectfully, and we became friends. And he was 43 years old, and I was about 22, but we became friends. We respected each other for our professionalism at this point. And he started teaching me maps and tactics and how to position troops. And what we would do is he and I and a driver would go out and survey the terrain, because once we went to our real positions, the whole emergency deployment plan of Europe is blown, because now they know where we truly are, which means that the rockets and the artillery can be trained in on the real positions. So it became obligatory for us now to find all new positions for the whole theater, all the way from Italy up into Scandinavia. And we didn't do all that. We just did our sector. But that's what we did. And so we went out for a week driving around. And everything, again, it's like, if I put a squad here down to the guy, you know, I have two riflemen, and I've got the automatic rifles and the grenade launcher, five-man team, four-man team? Do they have cover? You know, can they be far enough apart to get the fields of fire overlapping, but not too far apart that they become ineffective, and not too close that, you know, and what kinds of terrain does the enemy have to its advantage in its advancement, and taking all the stuff into and knowing that there's not optimal kinds of conditions, and so the compromises we make potentially are going to cost lives of innocent kids just because they happen to be this guy, this platoon, this squad, this time. That's what we did. And we had to include artillery and tanks, and like we had a forward air, you know, we called in air strikes, and we had all of this capability. We had crypto. We could encrypt messages and send them that couldn't be, you know, and had the possibilities actually of linking directly with the Pentagon, so that, you know, we could be an information gathering unit. And again, I mean, if our mission's 3 hours, they got to get it pretty quick. I mean, they can't rely on anybody remembering. It's got to get it quick. And so I learned. And as time went on, the Army was not good at training new lieutenants. We had a war. We needed a lot of manpower. We had a lot of civilians, and we had to try to make a big army, a combat army. We had to do it quick. And officers' candidate school was one way of doing it, but it was something like a 120-day program. ROTC, which is the Reserve Officers Training Corps, on universities, it's a course that people can take for 4 years. And they teach you how to march, they teach you how to break down a weapon, probably you fire the weapon, and you don't know anything. But you are commissioned an officer, and you take over command of a company, and you have all the responsibility. You call the shots, and if you don't know what you're doing, you get people killed. At one point, before I went into operations, when I was in the line company, we were sent a second lieutenant, which is the first rank a commissioned officer gets. That's the lowest rank. Who was a ROTC graduate from the University of Detroit. And he was not a bright guy, but he got through college. And he just skated by, and he didn't know anything. We as a group were kind of hardened veterans, even though we hadn't been in for years and years. We spent all our energy. I mean, we were good at what we did. And you don't walk into a group of men like that and just take control and dismiss these people as nothings. But an example is that the way the rations, each individual meal was boxed. And so, like, if you're going to eat dinner, you get a box, and in the box is a couple of cans of stuff, and, oh, you know, a pack of four cigarettes and some toilet paper, salt, pepper, instant coffee, and maybe, you know, a 25-year-old cookie. And the stuff was old, and it was awful. It was awful. I mean, it was terrible. And what, see, another thing, okay, we're in Europe, and there's all kinds of other influences. 1967-68, the United States was starting to understand that it was encountering a problem with the euro dollar. Euro dollars were American dollars that had been somehow found their way into Europe. Well, they still had claims in terms of goods and services, and so it was an inflation kind of a problem, and they wanted to attract euro dollars back because inflation and things like that. You know, they refused to accept the fact that defense is by definition, I did graduate work in economics, and by definition, defense is inflationary. People earn money to spend it, but nothing's put into the market basket commensurate with those monies to be consumed so that the market basket stays constant, but the quantity of dollars or money auctions the prices up, and that's inflation. It's also viewed as a tax. That's what taxes are, too. They take money away from you, or buying power, however you want to look at it. So the fact that we're fighting a war through debt and the tremendous inflationary pressure there escapes our politicians. And so one of the things in Europe is, you aren't going to believe this, but I swear this is true. The bread that we ate in Germany was baked in the United States. And I didn't realize it until I mustered out and had fresh bread at Fort Dix, New Jersey. How stale this bread that we ate all the time. It was just stale bread. But it kept the dollars home. Milk. We got milk once a month. Got our whole allotment. And it would spoil. And we'd have to throw away milk halfway through, and we'd go without milk, you know. And it was nuts. I mean, I can't. And then this is a reality. Cooks in Germany could steal meat, and they could sell it to the Germans in the black market and make money. And so the trick was to somehow take the remaining food and spread it. I mean, we have more casseroles and garbage than. And it was like we had like the worst job, and yet we were treated with the least. We got nothing, you know. You see a helicopter. You're out there in the mud, and it's wet and cold, and you've been out 30 days. You know, we would go out 30, 45 days at a shot. Morning, 9 o'clock. First day, you'd have a formation, and these are the orders, and you go to your track. And you had a hot breakfast, and maybe you had a hot shower, and you had slept in a building with heat. Okay, you're kind of warm. And you know about lunchtime you're going to be cold, and you're going to stay cold for 45 and a half more days. Okay, and you're going to be hungry that whole time, and it's going to be real hard to keep clean because they don't provide for that. You do the best you can to build a fire and heat a little water in your helmet and wash the dirt off. But it's really hard because you're out in bitter conditions. I mean, we're not talking about tents. We're talking foxholes. And fires can't be seen because that gives the enemy, you know. All the training assumes there's an active enemy. You can't smoke because a cigarette can be seen. And it might be literally 20 below in a snowstorm, but we're driving down the road and our heaters are broken. We didn't have heaters. They had heaters in Vietnam on their army personnel carriers, but we didn't. And it's just all part of this madness that the military, and you've got another guy behind you with a machine gun standing in this open, as an air guard, standing out in this cold, and I'm driving. And because we can't let enemy airplanes sneak up behind us. The fact that people are getting frostbite is irrelevant. Doesn't matter. This is what we do. I remember one time I was driving a Jeep, Biggins and I, in this big convoy, and it took us something like 12 hours. And I had a leaking tire, and I had to slow down. And by the time we got to this assembly area where we were supposed to get hot food, we were late. They were breaking down, leaving. And this lieutenant, an officer, told me to change the tire. I couldn't. My hands were frozen. See, we didn't, not only did we not have a heater, we didn't have a top. Honest. I mean, and you couldn't put the tops up if you had them, because of the threat of the enemy aircraft. You see, you had to be combat ready all the time. And it was like my hands were, I couldn't do it. And so this lieutenant got all angry and wound up changing the tire. And I didn't feel a bit sorry for him, but we didn't get to eat. So we're 12 hours in the snow, and your body heat depends on your food intake, you know. And we got none. This is just how they treat you. You look up, you see a helicopter. Those guys are going to have a hot meal, hot bed, shower. They're going to be fine. Just all of this stuff. I went to an Air Force base for some special training. And I'll never forget this because I'm in line. You know, everything's cafeteria style everywhere in the military. Got my tray. This guy asked me something. I didn't understand. I said, what? He was asking me how I wanted my eggs. And I didn't understand what he meant. It was like they were willing to cook eggs the way you wanted them. That was so far from my experience that I didn't understand what he wanted to know from me. And when he gave me a choice, I didn't know what to say. I was like, I couldn't, you mean you really, like if I wanted scrambled eggs, you'd do that? Yeah. And it was such an eye-opener that the Air Force, people in the Air Force got treated kind of like humans, you know? And we just, I don't know why that was, but boy, it was.
Sounds like the World War One, you know, what the infantry were called, the poor bloody infantry.
Yeah, it was, and it's still there. I mean, I don't know about today, but I suspect today is probably the same. Another thing, and this wasn't a big thing, but it was a morale kind of a thing. We were a self-contained unit. Everybody else, the Germans came in and did their KP, and the Germans did the cooking, and it was a nice arrangement because it was a boost to the German community and their economy and jobs and things, and the GIs could be doing whatever their jobs were supposed to be, but not us, because we had to be sure that we didn't have spies poisoning our food, contaminating our laundry. So we had to do all this in garrison and out of garrison, you know. And I mean, it wasn't a big deal except that nobody else had to do it.
This business, you know, it's very interesting what you were saying about the effects of the invasion of Czechoslovakia on you. Although you didn't see a lot of it, you know, obviously the effects of the fact that you had to replan the positions and that.
Well,
but, you know, what would you say the Russian threat was at that time? You know, it's interesting the sort of attention you've given to Vietnam. That war was ongoing, and yet the Americans were engaged in Europe.
Well,
how important was Russia and the threat perceived to be?
I remember watching television as a child, seeing Nikita Khrushchev pounding the table at the United Nations, screaming, "We will bury you." And I was never given any reason to not believe that.
What did you think he meant by bury you?
I thought it would be a military conquest. I was born 1945. I was young with the discovery of the A-bomb. I remember being a young boy in school, worried about the bomb and the end of the world. I remember one time asking my father why, I mean, the Russians were evil. That's how they were portrayed here. And again, I'm not old enough to doubt that what these people are telling me is anything but the truth. And it was, we're good and free, and they're bad and restrictive. And it's them against us, and we have to win, because if we don't, evil triumphs. And it was pretty clear that, simplistic but clear. I knew that before I saw Khrushchev burying us. To me, meant the rubble of my house, literally. I asked my father once, because I thought, you know, it seems to me in my thoughts that there'd be some little Russian kids kind of like me that aren't real interested in hurting me, and I'm not real interested in hurting them. And it's like, what is the difference of being a Russian and being an American that they hate me? What makes them, I mean, is it genetic, or why are they so clearly different that they're motivated out of a hate of me and out of a need to kill me when I don't have those same kinds of feelings for them? What makes us different? What makes them the way they are? And so I asked the question, like, why do the Russians want to kill us? And he gave me some answer. But I intuitively I knew that the answer was directed to the leaders of Russia. And I remember the question in my mind was, don't they have children? You know, 10 years old. who don't feel like that? What makes those kids different? And his answer was that the leaders of Russia have the people believing that we're bad and that they need to kill us. And it's all this deception and deceit, and they've been lied to. So it's like, well, yeah, really, maybe they're good people doing bad things because they have these lies about us and misunderstandings and think they're doing the right thing. Well, it satisfied me. It's like, we have to protect ourselves from these people. And sure, it never occurred to me that he meant anything but killing us. And the whole arms race and Cuba, 1962, the missile crisis. You know, they're 93 miles from Florida, and I mean, it's like, oh my God. You know, I was in high school getting ready to, and I wonder, I don't know the answer to this, but often I wonder, there's like a common thread here. The missile crisis, the vulnerability that I have to this Russian threat. I can't protect myself. Earlier when I was getting teary about the Ellsberg break-in, that while we're the statements, we will never commit our American boys, and the overwhelming public endorsement of Lyndon Johnson's public position on Vietnam, he carried 45 states out of the 50. That's a mandate. And yet, all the time planning the opposite. So here's an authority figure. See, again, I go back to kind of the incest, the sexual abuse as a child of being violated by an authority figure, having the military say, well, go ahead and do this. You won't wind up in the infantry, because that was everybody's fear. You'll still go to clerk school and, you know, and then having that taken away, and then finding out that the war really wasn't a just war or a moral war, that the vulnerability of, for me personally, of being perceived, at least, under the risk of the missile fire, the threat of Russia, the only thing keep in my mind, the only thing keeping the Russians out of West Germany was the American military force. Period. If we weren't there, they would be. It's almost like a power vacuum. Somebody's there, take them out, somebody's going to fill that void, and it would be them. And that would mean the potential loss of Europe and people, you know, good people, allies, freedom-loving people who would be eaten up into a tyranny and more oppressive rather than less oppressive society. So the threat was real, and I think that the invasion of Czechoslovakia was simply evidence that it was a real threat. We didn't think we were lucky to be in Germany. People in the United States did. 52% of the Vietnam returnees that came to our unit, 1049, and that's the number of the document, to transfer back to Vietnam. What we did was different. We weren't getting shot at, but our mission, I don't want to be comparative or competitive, but it wasn't fun and it wasn't good. I was entitled to 30 days leave a year, and I only got to take 12 of my 60 because of the job, you know, and I got to do that at the end. I was getting out December 22nd, so December 7th I was allowed to take 12 days of my leave, or I would have gotten none. I didn't see Europe. You know, I didn't go to Germany. I was out in the woods. I was on a border. But it was a real threat. I mean, we never thought that we were we didn't know we were not combat troops. Because we were. The threat was real.
Well, when you think now, though, you know, with the I suppose, the advent of Gorbachev and all that's been revealed and the change of attitude, it's true. But a certain amount of information has been revealed about the Soviet Union and its relative strength. When you look back now, what do you think of your perception of the Russian threat? Do you think you were misled by your country?
Totally. Again, this is another one of the authority. Sure, there was. As I look at it now, I mean, I don't know how the initial post-World War II conflict really became a conflict, but it's obvious. And even we had clues. We just didn't know how to put them together. We are a very wealthy nation in the United States with natural resources, and so is Russia. They're a much larger country. You know, they, as you know, they span seven time zones, have lots of raw materials. But they didn't participate in the Industrial Revolution like we did, and they didn't, and maybe their undoing is the spanse of the country, of the logistics of getting something from point A to point B, the geography and the climate, you know, the ice and the snow and like not having a warm weather port and things. They could not. So they have an economy much less developed than ours. And as I said earlier, defense clearly is inflationary, right? So it has to come from your bounty. If you don't have any bounty, all right. So they made some choices about standard of living and quality of life for the people in the Soviet Union to take more and apply it to defense than us. We could better afford defense because of our wealth and the way our economy had set up. Somehow we didn't put it together that they couldn't afford a military that met the same levels of ours. They simply couldn't. It couldn't continue for forever, and it didn't. And their undoing was economic. And we, it's like, I don't even believe we didn't know that. I don't know what the evil empire has been about. I don't know why we needed an enemy all these years. I wonder if Eisenhower, he wrote and made some comments about the military-industrial complex. And he made some statements about you really need to watch out for these folks. And see, another, in my experience, I worked at McDonnell Aircraft. They built jet fighter planes. Their only customer was military. Now, it could be United States. We built planes for England and Iran. And when I left, I think they were developing one for Israel. When I would be at work, there would be generals, Air Force generals and admirals from the Navy conducted around the plant, and we would see them from time to time. And what it turned out, and I didn't know this at the time, but what it turned out was that McDonnell was a military aircraft manufacturer. Douglas manufactured civilian planes. Lockheed manufactured some military. General Dynamics was a military. There was a handful of companies that produced aircraft, jet fighters, bombers. They were competing, and one of the things that they did is they would hire retired generals as consultants. Okay? And what that means is if I'm a general, and I'm 5 years or less from retirement, I'm thinking about my retirement, maybe 10 years from retirement, doesn't matter. And if I see a company that's pretty good to retired generals, it's like, in addition to my pension, you know, I can pick up another very lucrative jobs. I mean, $100,000 when $10,000 jobs were good, okay, as a consultant. And I'm going to be careful to not step on the toes of this company, because when my time comes, I may want to be a consultant for them. And in its basis form, it's influence peddling. It's before the fact, you know. People have pointed out that Ronald Reagan was invited to go to Japan and give a speech and paid $2 million for his speech, you know? And the point of this is, do the Japanese care $2 million worth about what Ronald Reagan has to say? And the answer is no, they don't give a damn. But the message here is, George Bush, if you do what we want and don't screw up the balance of trade too badly and don't mess with our markets and don't try to impose tariffs on us or force us to be open to bringing in your products, then we'll probably invite you over to give a speech. You see? And that's all this is. So, I don't know what the evil empire or the Russian bear, I don't know what purpose the conjuring up of this mortal enemy and selling this to the population, because I grew up knowing they were bad. I knew if they had the opportunity, they would kill us. I mean, that was my reality. I knew that. I think that a lot of people in positions of power probably knew that wasn't true, and I don't know what the gain and benefit to them was for perpetrating this misimpression. But I wonder if it had to do with, I mean, ultimately, I think it had to do with greed, and I think it had to do with their self-interests, and I think it had to do with possibly manufacturing arms, selling arms. There's a